Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do we end up with if we give a lot away? Today is North Texas Giving Day, and as nonprofit organizations hope to match the more than $25 million generated by last year's one-day campaign, it seems a perfect time to dig into the research that links acts of philanthropy with better health, stronger relationships, and happier lives. The remarkable thing is those benefits are actually associated with the people who give their time, money, and energy to good causes. Hillary Davidson joins us to explain the research. She's a PhD candidate in sociology at the University of Notre Dame and co-author, along with Christian Smith, of the new book, The Paradox of Generosity: Giving We Receive, Grasping We Lose. Hillary, welcome to Think.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
We tend to think about the benefits to the recipients when we do something generous, right? How did social scientists begin to recognize that generosity rewards givers too?
Sure. So we initially started studying altruism and generosity amongst givers and the relationships that they have with those who receive, and noticed that there's quite a strong link between well-being and generous behavior. So being willing to give your time, money, resources, giving some of that away for those who may need it, we noticed some very strong empirically established links.
So tell us about the Science of Generosity Initiative and how it was set up to understand the effects of different forms of philanthropy.
Right. So, and you're completely right to say that there are many different forms of philanthropy and generosity. And part of this initiative was really to take a scientific approach in understanding what that looks like, not only for givers, but also for recipients. And the Science of Generosity Project as a whole has a conglomerate of different projects based all throughout the world to really get a better sense of what it means to not only to be generous, but what the outcomes are, the motivations are. And this particular study that we used for the Paradox of Generosity draws on a national survey of Americans, about 2,000 people, nationally representative, and 62 in-depth interviews of very carefully selected households. In the interviews, we really tried to try to get a better sense of what motivates people to be generous and what their practices actually look like and the sorts of experiences that they have after they participate in generous giving.
Were you able to establish, you know, people feel good after giving a gift? Does that continue to magnify when they are sat down for a couple of hours to talk about this? Do they sort of gain enjoyment based on being interviewed about this?
Absolutely. And that was one of the most striking things to me as an interviewer in talking with people. You could kind of even see the warm glow come over people's faces when they talk about the sorts of things that they're involved in with their communities or the time that they've been able to help a neighbor out by providing childcare or bringing soup over, giving money away to their colleges or to a cause that they particularly care about. So even in the interviews, people's faces would really show the happiness that they had experienced. And it's interesting, too, that with all acts of generosity, even one-time gifts, like, say, helping a friend out by pledging $20 for their charity run or helping out with a Habitat for Humanity home, that those sorts of activities also produce little jolts of happiness. But what really counts and what's really formative for people in terms of producing these better relationships and mental wellness outcomes, it's the practice of generosity. So consistently practicing generous behaviors, having a posture towards others, and thinking of things in win-win scenarios rather than win-lose.
So tell us about, you've already indicated a couple of these, but tell us about the different forms of generosity that you looked at, because many people might be thinking, well, I can't afford to give any money, so I'm out of this. But as you mentioned, things like, you know, walking the neighbor's dogs if they're out of town, mm-hmm. or taking care of, you know, kids can all fall into the classification of generosity.
Absolutely. And there are so many ways to practice generosity, whether that's giving money, which I think many of us, when we think about generosity, we tend to think about giving money away. And that's certainly an important component to generosity, especially for those who have surplus amounts of money that can be allocated away. But for many of us, time is just as valuable. Being a good neighbor, a good being a caring friend or family member, that absolutely counts as relational generosity. Even giving blood or donating organs. So there's so many ways that people can be generous. And what was really striking in the interviews with generous people who live far below the poverty level, so people we interviewed who were living, who relied on Social Security or welfare for their income, they found really creative and alternative ways to be generous that didn't involve money, but they were just as they were experiencing just as many of these positive effects as those who did have money and were giving money away, maybe giving time away. So it really is about thinking through the resources that we each have individually. And then how can we manage those resources and put them to use for others' well-being?
What could be the driver behind a phenomenon like better physiological health and more generous behavior?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in the book, we went through a few different causal mechanisms because we really wanted to figure out, okay, is it just the case that generous people are healthier and that's why they're more able to volunteer and give money, et cetera? Or is it that generosity causes this? And we found that, the links go both ways, that generosity can trigger chemical systems in the brain and body that increase pleasure and experiences of reward while reducing stress and suppressing pain. And that tends to lead to greater happiness and health. Even something as simple as getting out of the house and walking over to the neighbor's house to spend time, or running a volunteer stand of some sort, that getting out and about in the community increases physical activity, which in turn increases physical health.
Does it matter at all whether people feel as if it is truly their decision to do something generous, as opposed to feeling somehow compelled by peer pressure or social pressure or some other force?
That's a great question. And yes, it absolutely matters what the motivation is. So we do find that people who are motivated to practice generous acts in ways that are actually self-serving, that there isn't that same experience of well-being. And what we think is happening there is that generosity is a lot like love. It's something that can't be faked. It can't be counterfeited. In order to experience the sorts of positive impacts that we noticed in our interviews, it became very apparent that people had to genuinely desire the well-being of others. So not desiring their own well-being or, say, the social status that might come from taking on a chair position in a volunteer organization, but truly desiring the well-being of others is what leads to their own well-being.
It really is astonishing the lengths to which some people will go, the amount that they will give of themselves or of their resources. Is this something that people build up to over time in their lives?
Yes. It's interesting. We noticed that people who had older children rather than young children in the house tended to be more generous. And in part, I think that is just because it takes time to build up these sorts of community relationships and to become invested and to really have even the time and extra resources that you might need to be in these more visible positions. Because generosity is a practice, it's something that people engage over time, it is a trait, maybe even a virtue that can be built.
A strikingly small number of Americans give 10% of their income or more to charity. And I want to be clear that I understand that many Americans absolutely couldn't spare 10% of their income to give to anything other than, you know, paying the bills. But for those who can afford it, I wonder if there is a difference between, say, a church tithe that feels required and the benefits there and the choice to give to a charity or an organization that somebody has chosen on their own.
Okay, so this was actually one of the most surprising findings for me personally. There isn't much of a difference. It could be that the people we interviewed, even though their tithe was a requirement, they still experienced a sense of belonging to that community and a sense of I'm supporting something that I'm part of and is going out to other people as well. But we did have a couple of people who did feel compelled to give smaller amounts, say being a manager and needing to contribute a certain percentage of your income to the United Way, that those were seen as more, well, this is the duty that I have and this will help me in my business life to become a person of higher status. And that didn't seem to really function in the same way that a truly generous act did.
And apparently it doesn't work if you say, oh, my gosh, my blood pressure's through the roof. I have no friends. Okay, I'm going to write a check to X organization. That doesn't do the trick.
That doesn't do the trick, no. No, it really is about genuinely wanting the well-being of others and seeking to be part of a bigger community.
It does make sense that when you give your time or your money to some organization, no matter what they happen to do, it's something that you believe in, and then you feel more like a part of that organization, whether or not you do anything other than, you know, write that check or show up someday and stuff envelopes or whatever.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And that's another thing about generosity. Generosity and generous actions create social roles for people. So being the church secretary or being the person who provides snacks for Little League or the soccer coach or being the person who collects canned goods during Thanksgiving weekend, having these sorts of roles is really valuable to people and gives people a better sense of belonging, but also of efficacy, of believing that they're the kind of person who can get something done. And that feels good.
So it's a kind of an empowerment for people.
Definitely. Yeah. We noticed in our interviews that people spoke very fondly about the roles that they had taken on through their mostly like through volunteer work. It seemed to also translate into having a better sense of self-growth, of being someone who really believes that they can grow and they can improve and there are things in life that they can change. And of course, not everything can be changed. People are still realistic about these sorts of things, But yeah, absolutely. Generosity proved to be very empowering for people.
Hillary Davidson is my guest. She's a PhD candidate in sociology at the University of Notre Dame and co-author, along with Christian Smith, of the new book, The Paradox of Generosity: Giving We Receive, Grasping We Lose. You can join the conversation, maybe share a story of your engagement with philanthropy or generosity by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Hillary Davidson, a PhD candidate in sociology at the University of Notre Dame and co-author, along with Christian Smith, of the book The Paradox of Generosity, Giving We Receive, Grasping We Lose. Today, of course, is North Texas Giving Day. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. So, Hillary, as you mentioned earlier, you did a number of extensive interviews with different people about their attitudes about generosity. I have to ask you now, we've been talking a lot about the benefits to people who are generous. You did speak to some people who don't believe this is important. And I have to tell you, a couple that you interviewed, the Arnolds, were almost hard to believe in how very unwilling they are to give. And it seems to be that their lives reflect that sort of cynicism about anybody doing anything decent for anybody else unless there's an ulterior motive. Can you tell us a little bit about them? And by the way, is that their real names, Doug and Michelle Arnold?
Oh, absolutely not. No. we give everyone pseudonyms and we change all identifying markers of people to maintain confidentiality. So with the interviews, we specifically sought out households that were either quite generous or quite ungenerous. And then we also sought out households that fit in between. The Arnolds are part of that group that fits in the in-between, actually. And so it's not as though they're not the most cynical household we spoke with, which was interesting. But their stories and the way that they understand life, it reflects a general trend that we noticed throughout our interviews with people who forgo the practice of generosity, and general trends of, cynicism, of believing that we live in a world of scarcity rather than abundance, and really of believing that we – each individual person needs to take care of themselves first and foremost, because the safety nets are not there. The social support will not be there. So if you fall down, you are the only one who can pick yourself back up. And I think it's worth mentioning that we did these interviews in the summer of 2010, technically after the Great Recession had ended, but still the majority of American families still suffering the outcomes of the recession. And the Arnolds in particular, they had been through a year in 2008 in which they were worried about possibly losing one or both jobs. They had purchased a home that they were finding that they just couldn't afford. They had had an unexpected pregnancy. So all of these factors that really weigh on people's pocketbooks and make it difficult, right, to see the world as an abundant place when you're trying to stretch pennies and you're worried about what happens if everything falls apart. But at the same time, the Arnolds had, like many of us, had these great ambitions of, I would like to own a beach house and I want to be able to send my child to a private school where other children will not be included. All of these different factors of really wanting to create a space of safety and security, but only for their own family. The possibility of providing security or safety to others just wasn't on their radar.
What struck me about them, Hillary, was that they did not believe that anybody under any circumstances would reach out to help them. They just didn't have that confidence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so they, like many people, they live in out in the suburbs, and it's sort of a place that really could be any place at all. It's a rotating crop of white-collar workers who move around for the job, for the next step up the ladder. And so they are part of this community that's in flux and in transition, and the neighbors are coming and going. And to some extent, they've really come to see themselves as being self-reliant. And then seeing other people as possibly trying to take away from what they have. So because they understand that they would rather not be, they wouldn't want to be asked to help out or to give money. And both Michelle and Doug talk about having to give money to, say, like a friend who's running for a charity race and doing it, but not really wanting to be part of that. But for them, generosity is really about being put upon. It's not about giving. It's about things that are being taken away. So it's a life is more of a zero-sum game for the Arnolds.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Jean in Dallas. Hi, Jean.
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much. I first want to start off by saying I've already made my contribution to KERA, and I encourage everybody to do so.
Thank you.
But my question is around this, and you guys touched on it earlier. There have been years where I could not give as much as I would have liked, but what I've made each year is the focus is to try to have a plan for how much I can give. Is that typical for most people, or is it more ad hoc for the average person? And I'll take my response off the air.
That's an interesting question. Thanks.
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, it's something that we have thought about including more in the book. But we did notice that people who consistently practiced generosity had more of a mindfulness and a planfulness in their generosity, because it does take a great deal of planning ahead, right, to give a significant amount of money away or even a significant amount of time. So the planning that's involved tended to also translate into other benefits for generous people, such as having a better sense of being able to negotiate time schedules or different kinds of savings and bank accounts. So lots of practical benefits to giving as well, including the planning.
Back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also email think@kera.org. This time we have Bill on the line in Dallas. Hey, Bill.
Hi, great show.
Thank you.
I had one of the things you guys brought up was, you know, what motivates people to give. And for me, a lot of it has to do with where it's going, obviously, but also how much of that is actually being, you know, used for the charity. There's been, you know, countless, investigations of charities that, you know, less than, you know, 3 or 5% actually go to the charity itself. And for me, that's a big deal. And that's one of the things that stops me from giving sometimes. So have you found in your research, information on that? And do you think there should be more oversight to be sure that these charities are actually giving to the cause that they're representing?
Thanks for your call. Probably a common concern, Hillary.
Yes, that concern came up quite a bit, both with people who were financially generous and those who were not. So those who were not often cited not having or being worried that their money would be used for things that wouldn't actually contribute to the charitable cause that they had wanted to contribute to. And absolutely, Bill, I think that more information, at least according to our interviewees, more information is needed from organizations to people as they're trying to solicit donations, and oversight as well. There are certainly good reasons to be cynical about certain charitable organizations, and it's wise to look into how that money will be handled and used once you've given it away. And yeah, absolutely, you are not alone in wanting more information and oversight from charitable organizations.
Does the same, say, $100 donated give us the same pleasure whether we give it to one organization or 10 different organizations? Does that matter?
Ooh, that's a good question. It doesn't seem to matter, no. Yeah, and you might think that, giving one larger lump sum might make you feel better because you're able to make more of a contribution with one particular organization. But really, the mechanism at work seems to be holding your resources loosely. So being able to give the $100, whether it's to one group or to 10, you're still able to let go of some of what you have.
So how much, if giving becomes a practice and it's something that people do over the course of a lifetime, how much do the patterns of one's family of origin matter?
Oh, hugely. You know, and that's something that we couldn't get into much in this book, but there will be another book from the same data set forthcoming, looking into how family of origin plays into generous behavior. So people who grew up with or people who grew up watching mom or dad or grandparents give money at church or bake for the school bake sale or whatever it is, caring for neighbors, being the neighborhood point person to provide meals for people. So seeing that as a kid has an impact on people. It gives them a sense of this is how a responsible adult should act, and this is what I should do. It doesn't always translate perfectly, and a lot of people have stories of being burned badly by generous organizations or by charitable organizations. But yeah, families and practices growing up matter hugely.
How do people ideally want to be asked for their generosity?
Ooh, that's a great question. it seems that people most appreciate not a fancy pamphlet that looks like it costs a ton of money. But they really, they like to be involved in things, and they like to see what the outcomes are and knowing what their money is going towards. So being able to see either in pictures or with stories, images, whatever it is, but being able to have a sense of this is what my money is going towards. So taking it from kind of an abstract, I'm giving money to X, Y, or Z, and then turning it into I bought a bench for this park, or I did something tangible. So being able to have a sense of tangible outcome, that seems to be a really great way to ask people to give.
So there are the gifts that we can give now, and then there are the ones that we say you are welcome to when I have shuffled off this mortal coil. And that's not only, you know, sort of estate giving, but also things like organ donation. Are the psychological rewards of those any different?
You know, they mostly hold. The impact, however, isn't nearly as great as you might expect, right? So, if you haven't actually gone through with the giving, you're not going to experience the same level of happiness or health as a result of that. But you certainly do. You do get that sense of that feel-good sensibility when you're willing to say, okay, after I die, like I would like my whatever resources I have left to go to this organization that I care deeply about, or even being able to envision your organs giving life to someone else or giving someone a new start, that could be very gratifying. But it isn't as gratifying as giving in the here and now.
This is a really fascinating revelation. People who are either generous or ungenerous tend to find themselves matched up with partners who have similar attitudes about giving.
Yes, absolutely. And that that is probably a good thing. The households that we interviewed with people who were matched with a generous person and an ungenerous person tended to be rather unhappy in that marriage. And that went on both sides, for both the generous person and the ungenerous person. And it, you know, what was really interesting and unfortunate about this is that the ungenerous spouse often felt slighted by the generous spouse's habits and felt as though they were being generous with everyone except for their own, like, family and in the marriage. And they did have some good points there. It seems as though to be it's very difficult, right, to be a holistically generous person, both in the private sphere and in the public sphere and with all of the relationships that we might have in our lives. But yeah, it is interesting that generosity and generous practices can be somewhat divided between in the home and outside of the home.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Diane on the line in Highland Village. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I just was wondering if there was a correlation between whether or not someone's generous or not and his or her political affiliation.
Interesting. What'd you find, Hillary?
That's a great question. You know, we didn't find too much of a difference there. So there is quite a bit of research that suggests that conservatives tend to be more generous, but that didn't necessarily bear out in our study, especially when we consider all of the different ways that it's possible to practice generosity. So political affiliation didn't seem to have as much of a strong effect.
Yeah. My guest is Hillary Davidson. She's a PhD candidate in sociology at the University of Notre Dame and co-author, along with Christian Smith, of the new book, The Paradox of Generosity: Giving We Receive, Grasping We Lose. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Today is North Texas Giving Day, and we are speaking with Hillary Davidson, a PhD candidate in sociology at the University of Notre Dame and co-author of The Paradox of Generosity: Giving We Receive, Grasping We Lose. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We have an interesting email here from Jerry, who writes, "I have suffered terribly with depression since I was 14. In 1998, during a very difficult time, my psychiatrist suggested I join Habitat for Humanity. It broke the spell, and I've been a volunteer ever since. I could never thank the doctor enough for all he did for me with just that one suggestion."
Wow, that's really powerful. And that's something that we heard in our interviews as well. So people who began volunteering in an attempt to come out of a depression. Their experience was that they had a better sense of purpose and of giving back and getting out of a self-absorbed funk in some cases. That generally holds true in other research as well, that volunteering is a great supplement to treatments for depression.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Casey on the line in Southlake. Hi, Casey.
Hi. My question was there any study done about corporate, charity work, especially where, they use employees, they do programs like, Habitat for Humanity. Was there any interviews done with employees? Why do corporations do this? I'm sure there's a lot of genuine charitable work, but what do they get back?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah.
They're less depressed. They're healthier.
Yeah. Well, actually, the people we talked with who participated in these corporate charity programs, they tended to see it more as something that they were doing for work rather than something that they were doing because they genuinely wanted to do it, right? And they sort of had a pretty cynical stance towards things of I do this for my work, and the business in turn looks good, and the community, we look like we're participating. Maybe we'll get a few better breaks with local legislators. But really taking a more cynical stance of seeing generosity as instrumental and almost the rational, practical thing for a business to do rather than these corporate charity programs as being like truly invested in the community and being a partner in the community.
I wonder if
I'm sure that's not true for everyone.
Well, I wonder if it's different in organizations where there's like a matching gift program so that the employees choose whatever nonprofit they like, and then employers commit to, putting up a certain number of dollars for every dollar the employee puts up.
Oh, that's a fantastic idea. Yeah. And, thinking through the research that we did for this book, I could definitely see that working well. When people have a sense of choosing their generous practices, the benefits are much more likely to accrue. Yeah.
What did you it's not so directly addressed in the book, but I wonder what your ideas are about creating a foundation for children of philanthropy.
Oh, yeah. So creating a foundation to...
creating a foundation. It's funny that we're talking in this language today. How we can set up a habit within young people, within children or students, for thinking about philanthropic giving.
Oh, that's a fantastic question. Because it matters so much, according to our research, it matters hugely that a person genuinely wants to give and genuinely wants to be generous and really wants to share their resources, not because it will promote their own well-being or health or their own happiness, but because they know that it will directly impact someone else and bring happiness and well-being to someone else, that's truly the posture that matters. So I think when we're talking about creating a foundation for kids and for teenagers, being able to talk about the ways in which we're all related to one another, that it's not as though we are atomistic, standalone individuals, like, say, the Arnolds might think of themselves as being, but rather we are part of a community, and we may not be able to solve every problem or social ill, but we can certainly do something to make a difference. We can look carefully at the resources and the gifts and the talents that we have and think through how might I use those to benefit someone else. And then also shifting out of having a mindset of scarcity and a belief that there's really not enough to go around. So if I get something, I have to hold on to it tightly. So shifting out of that mindset and into one of more of abundance, of believing that that there will be enough, that there is enough, and having a sense of security and trust in the communities and in the families and the neighborhoods that children are a part of.
lots of us who engage in volunteerism or give contributions to nonprofit organizations, you know, enjoy being thanked, right? Which is perfectly appropriate. We've done something we didn't absolutely have to do, and it feels good. Is there something special, though, about people who give quite generously and say, I don't need or want any acknowledgement?
Oh, yeah. You know, and it's completely appropriate to want to be thanked or to enjoy receiving some gratitude for what you've done. But yeah, those who give anonymously and are able to still see what it is that they've done, that I think is a really special act of generosity. And it really, you know, it really reinforces the belief that that it's not just, we're not just a community of individuals, separate and distinct and whatnot, but we really are, and we really can be, part of a social family. And so by making an anonymous gift or donation, it's almost attesting to the fact that you are part of this community rather than this individual standing above and beyond those who might need your help.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Rhonda on the line in Allen. Hi, Rhonda.
Yes, hello. I am thinking along the lines of colleges and universities and thinking about some of the historically black colleges and universities which were started not necessarily for totally altruistic reasons. It's kind of like the couple that she referenced in terms of they want to make sure that everything is set for their family but not necessarily everyone else's family. So I'm thinking about the Spelmans and the Morehouses of the world who were started by, let's say, the Rockefellers to make sure that their slave children had a wonderful place to go to school, but they didn't want them to go to Harvard or Yale or Princeton, any of their key universities. So but of course, we have all benefited from what they did. Even though, again, it wasn't like 100%. We want to set aside this place just for you, but not for you to come to our university. So it's just a rich history, regardless. But along that same line of colleges and universities, how do you suggest that we go about encouraging alumni members or people who have truly benefited from those universities to give back to those universities? Or any other type of organization, but I'm in the college and university mindset now because we're trying to raise money for our university, and you know it can be very challenging. So through your research, what are some of the ways that you have found that to encourage people to give back to something that they have benefited from?
Thanks for your call, Rhonda.
Yeah, great question. So I can't speak from the research directly in terms of like what's appealing in terms of colleges and universities. Although, I mean, we do have a few anecdotal cases of people who would get letters from students who they had helped support. I know for me personally, getting the call from my alma mater and talking with a student about their own experience before they ask for money has been pretty impactful. I mean, just being able to connect with the people who you would possibly be supporting, I think, is really powerful, and establishing a relationship of some sort in that capacity. So talking with actual students who will benefit, or and again, this is really about giving people some tangible sorts of outcomes or stories or real people to better understand like what it is that their generosity is doing and how they're making an impact.
Hillary, did you meet any converts through the course of your interviews? People who said that they weren't always generous, but they had sort of turned over a new leaf?
Yes. You know, one of my favorite interviewees, I think we call him Henry Fountain. He talked about growing up and really seeing the world as a place of scarcity, and he had no interest in giving to other people. And he had this moment where he really realized how small his world was going to become, and that realization it altered him. this realization that he is part of a bigger community, and he can do something, and he wants to do something. And, you know, so he became a he works in a caring profession now, I think gives 10% of the family income to various charitable organizations. And one of the most peaceful men we talked with in this in the process of doing these interviews, but just got a ton of joy out of knowing that he was creating creating possibilities for people through his generosity, especially since he himself had come from a background of poverty. And so being able to see people who were able to get to the place where he had gotten in life, I think really made a difference. And that was a very inspiring interview to conduct.
Depending on how and where you spend your time in this country, you can either really be exposed to a lot of other people who are involved in generous behavior or not. I was interested that a couple of the people that you spoke to, including those who admitted to being not so very generous in the past, said, oh, now that I think about this, it is something I want to do. Did that surprise you?
Yeah, it did. Well, it did and it didn't, because I think anytime you get to sit down with someone for 4 hours and in an interview setting where you're asking people all sorts of probing questions about their lives and you promise not to judge them, and basically as an interviewer you listen and accept their answers. So I think allowing people that sort of space to speak freely and honestly allows people to reflect a bit more on things that they might not normally think about. And generosity for many people is something that that isn't on the radar so much. A lot of people at the end of the interviews would ask us, gosh, you know, you guys had a ton of questions about giving money and time, like that was pretty boring. We had people tell us that our interviews were boring, which was sad. But we also had a few people who talked with us at the end about how just by talking about their lack of giving and kind of realizing how tightly they were holding on to things like their time and care and money. That they were interested in maybe turning a new leaf. Yeah.
Do you find, we just have a few seconds here, but are people who are generous more aware of the generosity they've benefited from in the past?
Yes, absolutely. I think that that's such a striking thing, too. The connection between generosity and gratitude is so prevalent. I think that being a generous person really increases the amount of gratitude that you have for others and refocuses life in a way to see that that just as you're giving to others, others have given to you and making it possible for you to give.
Hillary Davidson is a PhD candidate in sociology at the University of Notre Dame. Her new book, written with co-author Christian Smith, is called The Paradox of Generosity: Giving We Receive, Grasping We Lose. Hillary, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and Lindsay Connect and engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had help on the phones today from Addie Sun. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org, and you can find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.